Great. Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Kelly. It is March 3rd, 2010 at 2:10 p.m. As I asked you before we got started, do you consent to the tape recording of this interview?
I do.
Okay. Mr. Kelly, my name is Brad Bondi. I'm with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I'm the Assistant Director and Deputy General Counsel. These are my colleagues who you just met. Jane Poulin, who's an accountant, Donna Norman, and Karen Dubas, who's a research assistant and paralegal for our group. As I mentioned, we're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We're a commission that was established by Congress as part of the Fraud Enforcement Recovery Act of 2009 to investigate the causes of the financial crisis, both domestically and globally, and to do a report for the President and Congress and the American public. The report's due December 15, 2010. Part of our mandate includes looking at certain practices, whether it be lending and accounting practices, securitization practices, I believe even taxes is in one of our 22 specific mandates in Congress. We're also obligated under statute to look at the financial institutions that collapsed or would have collapsed but for substantial government assistance. So we are here as part of our inquiry into the financial crisis. This inquiry is confidential, so we ask that aside from your lawyers, you don't talk to anyone about what we've talked about today. But this information that we use today could be used in a public forum or report to the American public. So this isn't, but this is up to our determination how to use this information. I'm obligated because we are government agents to tell you that 18 U.S.C. 1001 applies, and that says that it's in a nutshell, and your lawyers have already probably told you about that, but providing willfully or knowingly providing false information to the government is a crime. But I have no reason to believe that you're going to provide us any false information, Mr. Kelly. But you've been designated, sir, as someone who is knowledgeable about the requirement for government assistance. In particular, in fact, I think I just read it exactly. We asked for a witness to be designated to talk about the requirement of government assistance in 2008, and we understand that you're knowledgeable about that topic. Is that correct?
It is.
Okay. And because we're being recorded today, I just ask that you answer your questions yes or no as opposed to nodding your head.
Understood.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Kelly, what can you tell me about the events that precipitated the need for government assistance in 2008?
Well, as you know, there were three pieces to that. I'm familiar with the last two as opposed to the first one. The first one, as you know, was the TARP injection, which went to the nine largest firms of which we were a part. My recollection is that was in the form of $25 billion worth of preferred stock. That was, I believe, in October of 2008. Between October of 2008 and late November, and I think it was somewhere November 23rd, I think was the agreement with respect to the second injection, and that injection took two forms. One was an additional $20 billion worth of preferred that we received from the government, and the second, as you know, was what we've described here as a loss-sharing agreement, which I think is sometimes referred to as an asset guarantee program. I think the reasons for the first one have been well known. Others are more familiar with it than I. I think the Treasury in particular and the administration at the time, along with the regulators, are very concerned about the systemic issues that became vivid during the fall of 2008, concluded that it made sense to implement TARP in the way that they did. With respect to the second one, what I can tell you is what it is that we did in the course of our conversations with the government. What I'm less able to tell you is why, because I think the fact is that the reasons for it are, in one respect, less than transparent, are probably going to be the subject of a lot of discussion and speculation over the ensuing years. Having lived through it day by day, I have the sort of vision that's obscured by having been as close to it as I was, and also by not being able to tell you precisely what the market dynamics were around the creation of the situation that occurred in late November. there are two things that strike me at a very high level about it. One is that I think in the wake of the failed Wachovia transaction, there was a great deal of focus on Citi for a couple of reasons. One is Citi historically, as you know, had not had the sort of presence as a national matter that some of our perceived peers did, whether it's Bank America, Wells, or J.P. Morgan. But for years, it actually done quite well, essentially being more internationally, more wholesale focused with a smaller presence in the United States. That's not to suggest that it wasn't substantial, because it was, but it was smaller than our peers. After we announced the Wachovia deal, ironically, I think there was a perception on the part of the market that we had now conceded that we needed a larger presence in the United States, that there was a value to deposit funding that we had been willing to forego for some time, but having agreed to do the deal was a recognition on our part that we needed it, and if we needed it and didn't get it, what did that imply for the strength of the firm going forward? One thing that's important to note about that, and it's frequently been, I think, either misperceived or misdescribed, is that we were approached in connection with that transaction. We had a very specific idea about what it is that we would do, and we were relatively persistent in our view that we would do it only under specific circumstances. Ultimately, I think the regulators and the government, because it was an open bank assistance transaction, concluded that it was sensible to accept our proposal. And ultimately, we reached agreement, as you know, in the very early morning hours of Monday, whatever day that was, and went forward from there. Because the deal was very complicated, it was not an acquisition of the whole firm. It was an acquisition only of the bank, not of the holding company, and involved insurance, as you know, around $300 billion of assets at the bank. To be blunt about it, at least as a particularized documented matter, we weren't sure what we had bought. We knew what we had bought conceptually. We thought that it was extremely important for systemic reasons to protect the debt at the holding company. And what had worried us generally was that if Wachovia were to fail and were to become going to a bank receivership, that that debt ultimately would, to use a term of art, splatter and have consequences that were, in my view, dramatic but not necessarily foreseeable. We thought that it was important to try to protect it. So our deal was structured acquisition of the bank for a nominal consideration, because our understanding was, as a policy matter, in connection with open bank assistance, the government and the regulators would insist that that compensation be nominal, an assumption of the debt at the holding company. We left behind other assets at the holding company, including liabilities, certain contingent liabilities. And we agreed, as you know, in a highly structured transaction to insurance around the $300 billion of ring-fenced assets at the time, for which we agreed to pay, I think, ultimately $14 billion in preferred stock, and to assume a first loss of $42 billion, I think $30 billion at the outset, and then more than $4 billion over a three-year period in the aggregate, $42 billion. So when you counted what we were willing to pay for it, we essentially provided $56 billion in consideration against insurance and $300 billion of those assets. Very complicated deal. We had to deconstruct the firm and then reconstruct in the process of documenting it. The only thing that we believed that we could do was to have an exclusivity agreement with them to ensure that we would be able to talk to them and have time to structure the agreement. Very difficult to structure a breakup fee of any description, because the truth is, our view was that to the extent that you did it, it would be easily invalidated because there was no describable economic deal at that stage. And as you know, ultimately, Wells reconsidered its position, and I think now well documented in light of a Treasury ruling with respect to taxes earlier in the week, concluded that it made sense for them to buy the whole firm. But there were two very different deals. Wells bought the whole company, no insurance. We bought just the bank, assumed the debt, and had insurance. So they were apples and oranges. Ultimately, Wells prevailed after three or four days of negotiation initiated by the regulators between us and Wells as to whether we could reach some agreement with respect to splitting the firm up. Thereafter, it was relatively quiet, although, as you know, developments in the market were not entirely positive, just generally. In other words, there was increasing unease, I think, in the fixed income markets in particular, to some extent reflected in the equity markets. WaMu had failed, as you know, Lehman had failed. AIG obviously was in distress and had been, quote unquote, rescued by the Fed. And as we went into November, there seemed to be almost sequentially focus on various firms and whether they were weak and whether they'd come under a crisis of confidence of some description in the market. Again, no idea, because it's obviously a huge number of factors that influence that. Our stock came under pressure, I think, that week of November 17th or whatever it would have been. As I think is well known, and as you've probably seen, there were a number of us who bought stock in the firm for our own account the week before. I bought stock the previous Friday at $10, and by the following Wednesday, the stock was at $3.50. Part of that, in my own view, was triggered by press speculation that there was some lack of consensus in the board and some potential lack of confidence in management and in Vikram Pandit in particular. That seemed to increase the market's unease, generating more uncertainty around the firm, and the stock began to fall. The feedback loop in the market between stock price and the comfort of the liabilities on the debt side had become much closer. So there was concern that to the extent that the stock continued to fall, some of our liabilities might become insecure, and therefore we'd face funding issues at the bank. I was not involved in any direct contacts with the regulators. In other words, any discussions of what it was that was worrying them. I was vaguely aware that there must be conversations going on. So the first time I got involved was, I think, that Friday, November 21st, when I was called and asked to come join a conference call with the New York Fed and Luke Caden, who's another vice chairman here, to talk about not why we needed assistance or whether we needed assistance, but how it is that we might structure assistance. In other words, the presumption was that we were going to get it. The issue was how and in what form. They asked us to think about it, which we did. So that's a very long-winded way of answering your question, which in the short answer being that I can tell you factually what happened, but frankly, my speculation is probably no better than anyone else's with respect to why.
Sure. Let me ask a few questions within that. First of all, you said we were approached, and just to be clear, who approached?
Wachovia. Yeah.
And who in particular, do you know?
Bob Steele called Vikram.
Okay. And a little housekeeping matter, which I should have started at the beginning. I understand and I have your background, and rather than go through all the background in the interest of time, but if you could briefly just tell us your background in terms of Citi and when you started in your current role and what your current role is.
Yeah, I started at, well, let me go back one step. I can do it briefly.
Sure.
As you know, I started life as a lawyer at Davis Polk, was a partner there, joined the old J.P. Morgan as general counsel in 1994, was general counsel for a year or so, moved to the business side, became an investment banker, ran our financial institutions group around the world, ran Latin America. We, as you know, merged with Chase in 2000. I decided to leave, went to run a bank in the Mid-Atlantic called Mercantile Bank Shares. I was chairman and CEO there from 2003 to 2007 and was CEO from 2001 to 2003. The reason I go back is because in late 2006 it became apparent to me that the credit markets had gotten a little bit frothy. Mercantile was a very conservative, well-capitalized, well-reserved bank that had done a very good business in the Mid-Atlantic for many years in middle market commercial. We found ourselves in a situation where it was very difficult to compete as a credit matter, so that we were now losing business or not being able to do business that we had historically done because price and terms had become so relaxed that it was difficult for me to justify it on a risk basis. We concluded in that light, given the growth challenges we faced and given how we thought about the market, the board and I concluded at that stage that it made sense to sell the bank. We did. We negotiated a deal with PNC, reached that agreement in late 2006, closed in early 2007. I was briefly vice chairman at PNC, but decided that it made sense for me to go do something else, so I was at Carlyle for 6 or 7 months. I went to Carlyle, organized a financial institutions group to focus on private equity with respect to financial firms for a whole range of reasons. It was more difficult than we might have guessed at the outset to raise money for that fund. I'd known Vikram for years, not well. We were not personally close or friends, but he had been an old client of mine when I'd been at Davis Polk and he'd been at Morgan Stanley. We'd known each other over the years, and John Havens, as you know, was another senior person here. We have a very close mutual friend. And I had talked to Vikram and John when they were still at Old Lane about the possibility of joining them. They sold the city. I went to Carlisle. 6 months later, they called and said, Vikram's now taking over as CEO. We clearly have some challenges. This was in late 2007, early 2008. Would you like to come join us? I thought if my purpose at Carlisle in one respect was to play distress in the market, why not come to a large distressed opportunity, not having any idea how distressed it would become, and join Citi in February of 08, initially as president of Citi Alternatives, then as CEO of Citi Alternatives. Then in September, I became retained those titles and became head of global banking. March of 09, I became the CFO. July of 09, I became the vice chairman. So during the period we're talking about, I was actually head of global banking, which at that point included Citi Alternatives. And global banking for that purpose is both the investment bank and the corporate bank. But the role that I was playing in terms of the fall of 08 and the government assistance was as banker to the firm, as an advisor to Vikram, and as the person who came in and helped to think about and structure deals.
Appreciate the background, and I apologize for not doing that up front. We should have done that first. But getting back to the need for government assistance, you've mentioned the Wachovia transaction and that failed to go through, failed to consummate. What other events precipitated the need for government assistance? What other events at Citi?
Hard for me to remember. I mean, I think I've highlighted those that I do remember. I do know that the market was... It's important to remember how the whole thing unfolded in one respect. I think the fourth quarter of 07 obviously revealed cracks in the balance sheets of a number of firms. Citi, Merrill, my recollection. Morgan Stanley, too, as I recall. First quarter of 08 was pretty horrible. Fixed income markets froze up. Liquidity was at a premium. Given the way the industry was funded at the time, which, as you know, was funded short, invested long, to the extent that short liquidity dries up, that generated lots of asset sales, which in turn depressed asset prices, which in turn created a vicious spiral down. Interestingly, in the second quarter of 08, things got a little bit better. You know, and I'm doing this more or less from memory, but my sense is that they got better. A little quieter after Bear, when the government obviously did what it did and JPM bought Bear. I think there was some sense of relief and relaxation in the market in the second quarter. As a result, it was a little better. Early part of the third quarter during the summer, which is normally slow, again, relatively quiet. And then in September, as you know, we had a sequence of events. Fannie and Freddie, we had Lehman, we had AIG, we had WaMu. So September, in many respects, was a nightmare from a market standpoint. And then there was further disruption, as I described, in terms of market uncertainty in the in terms of the Wachovia deal and how that unfolded. And then I think during October, I don't recall, and then that was settled to some extent by the TARP injections, because again, you'll recall, Congress first rejected TARP. 4 or 5 days later, they ultimately adopted it. Market uncertainty generated by that. Then they make the injections, which frankly nobody had expected, because TARP, as you know, was adopted as an asset purchase mechanism, ultimately became an equity injection mechanism, perfectly consistent with the statute, but a little different from what the market expected. But that settled things out again, because the government at that stage was perceived to recognize the systemic risk and was willing to support systemically important firms. And then in October, things were unsettled, but my recollection is not horrible. And then things began to accelerate again in November with increasing focus on particular firms and the worry in the market about which one was next going to become a target, in part because of shorting. And as I telescoped a lot, as you know, there was also an episode around the SEC banning short selling for a while, and then that ban was lifted, and there were various efforts made to stabilize the markets. Morgan Stanley and Goldman, as you know, became bank holding companies in the midst of all this. There were a variety of steps that were taken. But my point being that it was very choppy. You know, people were very concerned, high levels of anxiety, but very difficult for me as I look back on it to point to anything specific. And the only thing specific I can point to in the case of Citi really revolved around publicity and speculation about the stability at Citi, frankly, at that stage, really just on the management front. I mean, clearly concerns about, as there was with everyone at that stage, about balance sheet and funding and earnings going forward, but I don't remember any specific trigger for it. As a matter of fact, I expressly remember being bemused by the whole thing. As I said, I bought stock at $10 on Friday. It was $3.50 by the next Wednesday, and nothing had changed, and I couldn't possibly tell you why that was, other than the fact that the market at that stage had adopted a clearly a more negative view of the firm and its prospects.
Let me ask you, you mentioned short selling, and there have been some reports about the effects of short selling on financial institution stock, and you've described how the stock price dropped in this time period in November. How much do you attribute the effect on the stock price to short selling, and if you could give some more details in terms of the observations from Citi's standpoint concerning any short selling on its stock?
I wasn't close to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, I know that it was going on, but I was never focused particularly on the shorts, if you will, as a particularized evil in connection with Citi. I never really developed my own view about what the right solution was. The interaction between short selling and the CDS market, as you know, was much discussed, and I know has been much vetted by many, because the fact is that if you were to, depending on what your position was, if you were to buy or sell insurance and then ultimately short the stock, you found yourself in a position where instability in the firm was a good thing against which you were hedged. And I think there was a lot of discussion at that time about the interaction, as I mentioned earlier, between equity market prices and the debt holders' comfort with the firm. And that became a very vicious feedback loop. And I think we were seeing that because our CDS spreads, as you know, were blowing out at the same time that our equity price was falling. But it was nothing more than in my own impressions, obviously being a market observer, but no specific knowledge with respect to what was going on at Citi.
You referenced the challenges to the balance sheet. And obviously, Citi had its own challenges to the balance sheet, as you've referenced, in 2007, starting in 2007. And I understand you've mentioned the somewhat of the last straw in the concern with respect to the Wachovia deal, but how much did the challenges to the balance sheet at Citi really precipitate the need for financial assistance?
Well, that's a very complicated question. You know, and I think at one end, if we'd had no losses and the perception had been that our exposure to the market was limited, we would not have had an issue. Having said that, I think everybody was perceived to have exposure to the market, and it had gotten considerably worse than people might have guessed. And therefore, there was an enhanced focus, and the reason it's particularly complicated, there was an enhanced focus not only on capital levels, but the kind of capital. So for Citi in particular, what drove it was that our Tier 1 ratio, which, as you know, has historically been the ratio that bank regulators have looked at for purposes of assessing capital adequacy, was actually very strong through the whole process. What was curious about it was that our tangible common equity actually got to be quite low. And the market was very concerned about what they described as TCE, which, as Jane knows, is not even actually a sort of defined term. It's a market impression. Mm-hmm. But effectively, it's just common equity. They got to be worried about that and began to disregard Tier 1 capital. So notwithstanding the strength of our Tier 1 capital ratios, the market was concerned on tangible common because that's actually what's available to common stockholders. Mm-hmm. So clearly, the losses, or at least the perception of possible losses, had an impact on the common stockholders, and therefore, clearly, one assumes, had an impact on the stock price, which, for the reasons I described, in turn potentially had an impact on the liability holders. And at the end of the day, banks are hugely dependent, both banks and other financial firms, are hugely dependent on liquidity and their access to the fixed income markets.
What do you perceive was the reason to look more at tangible common equity from an investor standpoint than the capital levels?
I think in a very simplistic basis, as I said, that's actually what's available for common stockholders. So they were thinking if our tangible common equity, notwithstanding our Tier 1 capital, goes negative, there's nothing left for them. Given the anxiety, there wasn't the patience necessary to work through that, restore, if you will, tangible common equity to a positive value. I can't tell you that it was entirely, I understand it. I'm not sure it was entirely rational, but I understand it. And as you look back, you'll find that the regulators for a very long time continued to hew to the line of Tier 1 as being the most important. As you've probably seen, and I'm going to overstate it to make a point, there seems to have at least been some implicit capitulation recently as they focus on Tier 1 common as opposed to pure Tier 1.
Some commentators have described what happened with respect to firms as a loss of confidence, and I'd be interested to get your take on if you perceive there being loss of confidence in Citi and the reasons why you believe there might have been a loss of confidence. Was it the Wachovia transaction? Was it some other things? Was there a loss of confidence from investor standpoint that precipitated
this? Having lived through that and been an observer of the markets in various guises for many years, I think there was a dramatic loss of confidence across the board and around the world. I don't think it was city specific by any means. I remember describing it to somebody. You know, we obviously all believe that the dollar I have in my pocket is worth a dollar and is negotiable. It was as if that willing suspension of disbelief, because there's no particular reason you should believe that, in fact, evaporated. People were questioning what everything was worth at the time. As you know, there was a flight not just to quality and safety, but almost a flight to certainty. You could see that in terms of where yields were going with respect to Treasury securities and where yields were otherwise going with respect to other assets. There was, I think, in one respect, a classic panic. I think people will be thinking for years about why that happened. I'm not sure myself. I think part of it was that after an extended period where liquidity and capital were basically free or cheaper than they had been historically, the pendulum, not surprisingly, swung even more severely to the other side because there had been such a dramatic change in circumstances. I think Citi in particular, as you know, is global. It was large. It was in both the consumer and the wholesale businesses. If you look at it, and this has been confirmed by the stress tests that the Fed and the other regulators went through in the fall of 2009, we look very much like other banks. Having said that, if you separate the credit crisis into three pieces, the markets crisis, the consumer cycle, and I think what is potentially coming, commercial real estate and commercial industrial lending, we had more than our share on the first side. And remembering, at least anecdotally, my own impressions, we had a lot of exposure, as you know, to super senior securities that were deemed to be extremely safe. I think in most people's view, even as things unfolded, were regarded as being more or less bulletproof. Turned out for part of the reason I described in terms of liquidity and the need to sell assets in order to meet those liquidity demands. But the marks on those securities were really pretty severe. I think we were perceived at that time, perhaps rightfully, to have more exposure on that front than some of our peers, which arguably made us more vulnerable. But again, that's something, remembering my role as head of global banking and then ultimately coming in to try to help in terms of structuring things, that I was not intimately involved in either while it was evolving or even after the fact, frankly. But again, just an impression, some perceived vulnerability on that front.
How much did valuation play and valuing assets at Citi play in this perceived lack of confidence by investors?
I had no view on that. I don't think it was a valuation issue. I think it was a perception of exposures to various asset classes that were under pressure and an inability to assess where the bottom might be.
Mm-hmm. Citi, through the course of late 2007 and through 2008, had several write-downs. Can you tell us about the effect of those write-downs and announced write-downs in terms of adding to the otherwise challenges that Citi faced in the marketplace?
Well, I'd be the first to admit my recollection of that is not perfect by any means. And again, going back to it, I wasn't actually involved with that at the time. I was off running businesses. But my recollection, somebody will correct me quickly if I'm wrong, if you'll allow it, is the biggest write-down I think we suffered was in the fourth quarter of 07. Actually, I guess it was toward, no, yeah, that's right, fourth quarter of 07. Mm-hmm. We had a loss in the first quarter of 08, partially driven by write-downs, but less dramatic than the one in the fourth quarter of 07. I think we actually had a relatively minor loss in the second quarter of 08, and in the grand scheme of things, I think we lost $2.8 billion or something in the third quarter of 08. So I would argue that write-downs, you know, against the backdrop, obviously, of the scope and scale of the firm, didn't have a lot to do with it. The really big loss, as you know, actually occurred in the fourth quarter of 08, you know, relative to the first three quarters of 08. So I'm not sure that the write-down in the fourth quarter of 07 obviously set the stage for the perception that Citi had issues. I'm not sure that anything that happened during the first three quarters was wildly out of line with what was going on in the rest of the industry. So I'm not sure that there would have been anything there that would have distinguished Citi from anybody else.
With respect to Citi's subprime exposure in November of 2008, did that exposure lead to or add to the need for government assistance?
Well, the short answer to that, Brad, is I don't know, right? Because, again, going back to it, just to stress it, my role in most of these things is we have a problem. Would you please come help us solve it? I'm not intimately familiar with the constituent parts of that problem. In other words, I know it exists. Please help us get out of it. So for all the reasons I described earlier, hard for me to assess the role that our subprime exposure played quantifying it in terms of our need for assistance. As I said earlier, I think our exposures clearly generated a perception that we were potentially vulnerable, and that in connection with the market environment, which is characterized by all the features that we discussed, I think resulted in our needing assistance. But for me to parse each part of that, in part because of the role I played, in part because I'm not sure it's easy at all, is very difficult.
The Wall Street Journal reported somewhere around November 19, 2008, that the company's Citi's announcements on November 17th and 18th stoked investors' fears that Citigroup could be swamped by toxic assets flooding back onto its books.
And I, is that November 17th and 18th, 2008?
Yes, sir, 2008. And I'm curious to know if there was this concern with, as the Wall Street Journal describes, toxic assets flooding back onto Citi's books in November of 2008.
Not that I recall. I recall no discussion of it. I know that there were a lot of discussion, misguided in many respects, about our off-balance sheet exposures. Mm-hmm. Truth is, those off-balance sheet exposures, by and large, I think, are credit card receivables and certain other securitizations, but I wouldn't necessarily describe those as toxic. You know, the fact is that toxic was a term that was thrown around a lot, as you know, during that period. When you look at things even like the special asset pool, which we now have as part of holdings, I'm not sure I would describe even large parts of that as toxic. I think the ring fence that we ultimately agreed to with the government, the loss sharing agreement, actually involved assets that you would regard as pretty pedestrian. You know, it's predominantly mortgages, whole mortgages. Some corporate loans. They were basically all accrual assets, very few mark-to-market assets. But I remember that vaguely, but I don't remember thinking that was an issue particularly.
Now, we've heard and we've spoken with Bill Arnold,
yep,
concerning the special investment vehicles, the seven special investment vehicles out of London. We have a little bit of an understanding about what happened with the special...
Structured investment vehicles, just
yeah,
to be clear.
They're
excuse me, structured
in,
investment
as
vehicles.
To
sorry,
purpose
sorry.
Vehicles
SIVs.
Or,
SIVs.
Yeah. Structured investment vehicles.
Right.
I apologize. Ms. Burgle is keeping me honest with my acronyms, and I'm a slow learner when it comes to acronyms. But the SIVs, the seven,
yep,
SIVs out of London. We've spoken to Mr. Arnold about those SIVs, but the timing of the some announcements concerning those SIVs and the government, ultimately the government announcement of the government assistance, is curious to me. And by that I mean the following is there was an announcement on November 19th, 2008 that's of a $1.1 billion write-down on the SIVs. And I'm going off of my own notes, so to the extent that these numbers are incorrect, please correct me, but I'm not meaning for you to attest to numbers that you don't know, so let me just say that right at the outset. But according to my notes, Citi announced a $1.1 billion in write-off on the SIVs on around November 19, 2008, and Citi also announced that it would pay somewhere around $17 billion to unwind, as announced here, and unwind and compensate the holders of the SIVs commercial paper. Then the government assistance package was announced not too long after, on around November 23rd, 2008. I'm just curious, sir, if there was a connection there between what happened with respect to the SIVs and the need for government assistance.
I don't think so. You know, again, I can't say conclusively, but my own sense of it was that was by and large at that stage old news. You know, my recollection is the SIVs were consolidated at the end of 2007, I think. You know, based on the initial $3.5 billion that we'd injected at the mezzanine level. That had been roughly a year before. When I was at City Alternatives, I was actually involved in the wind-down of the SIVs. Mm-hmm. The SIVs, as you know, were basically banks that were non-deposit funded, that were short-funded. So they were funded very short in the market, invested very long. The issue we had in the SIVs was not credit quality. Credit quality was actually almost pristine, remarkably good. When I was there, my recollection is the only default in the entire portfolio was WAMU. Otherwise, the credits were all very solid. The marks were driven by the market dynamic I described, where short funding dries up. You've got to meet demands, therefore you sell assets. Selling assets into a falling market, you begin to lose sight of fundamental values and ultimately take big haircuts. I can remember looking at that, and I used to cite it frequently, where there were assets that I was absolutely confident in my bones were money good. And I'm sure have proven to be money good, that were trading at 65 or 70 in the market, principally because there was a liquidity issue. You know, there was another classic example of that, which was Carlyle Capital in early 08, as you know, was basically invested in implicitly government-guaranteed securities because it was funded short and because the haircuts changed. The whole thing ultimately imploded because the fact is they had to meet short funding demands, had to sell assets, and they ultimately had to wind it up. The reason that we made the decision that we did, as I recall, in November of 08, was that we had injected the $3.5 billion. I think at one point we may have injected, and I can't remember, but I think at one point we may have injected another billion, in other words, in order to support them. And at some point we concluded, this is crazy, right? You know, the fact is we just ought to take these back onto our balance sheet. To your point, it was only $17 billion at the time. There were marks associated with them because of that market dynamic I described. But in the grand scheme of things, I remember thinking at the time it was unexceptional, but a perfectly rational decision. They were already effectively on the balance sheet anyway.
Can I ask a clarification?
Please.
On the SIVs, I think you referred to them as they were basically banks that were short-funded. Mm-hmm. I don't recall whether I understood what the assets were, and I'm struck by your reference to them being banks. So
no,
maybe
I would say analytically. Analytically. I mean, banks basically incur liabilities and aggregate assets and manage it to a margin.
Okay.
They just incurred non-deposit liabilities that were short in the wholesale markets and invested those in long assets.
Then the assets were long.
Precisely. And there's just an asset liability mismatch.
Okay. Was there any similarity to the types of assets that they had?
No, they're pretty broadly across the board. Lots of financial assets. Some mortgage exposures, you know, I can't remember, but pretty broad-based. But by and large, as I said, the unifying principle around them, good credits.
The Qs and Ks actually have a breakdown of the underlying asset pool. It's about 60% financial institution debt, 20% European residential housing, very, very little subprime U.S. housing. I mean, almost minimis.
A lot of financial institution paper. So unless you believe the world was coming to an end, right, it was going to be money good. But I apologize for describing it.
No,
I was
using
thinking
the
about
term
it
generically.
And precisely.
And with respect to the SIVs, we were talking about the payment in November 19, 2008, but taking us back to 2007, what was your role, Mr. Kelly, with respect to the SIVs and the decision?
I wasn't here.
Okay.
I didn't show up till February of 08. You know, that was done when I got here.
I thought so. I wanted to make sure that there wasn't a role there that had not been mentioned. You've mentioned and described an effect that we've seen across several institutions, and that is the illiquid market affecting the valuation of assets.
Yep.
And I was just wondering if you could provide some further detail in terms of the challenges specifically that Citigroup has faced with respect to marking assets and the result in terms of investor perception and the like.
Well, certainly in the run-up to all this, Brent, I wasn't involved in it at all. Still had no view, no clue. As a more general market matter, as you know, I think it's fair to say that there was skepticism in the market generally about the marks, not just that Citi was taking, but that all firms were taking. In other words, given the illiquidity in the markets and given the lack of price transparency around certain assets, there were questions that emerged about, are they marked properly, which goes back to the point I tried to make earlier about an inability to perceive the bottom. In other words, where are these things going? But I don't remember and was not involved in anything that was city-specific in that connection.
And part of our mandate is to look at mark-to-market accounting.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if what your view was in terms of mark-to-market accounting and how it functioned during the course of the crisis and the aftermath.
Well, I have a variety of views on that, but that's I think mark-to-market accounting is fine, right? And I don't really have any. I mean, obviously, given the impact of it, it clearly has the effect of exaggerating market movements in the context of liquidity constraints, and it becomes difficult to separate, as I mentioned earlier, the fundamental value of a credit from its value in a context where it is very difficult to finance. So you essentially take an asset that people have assumed had value because they were able to finance it at certain levels. You remove that financing, it becomes a question of what it is that somebody will pay for it. And at that stage, clearly, not surprisingly, they are willing to pay less because the returns implicit in it are lower by virtue of the fact that they can't borrow against it. Having said that, I had no particular issue with the fact that it existed. The one broader issue that I've had with mark-to-market accounting is, as you know, it deals with the asset side of the balance sheet, but not the liability side. You know, and the fact is that liabilities sometimes have values that offset those potential marks on the asset side. But I think it's fair to say, for reasons that I perfectly understand, that you know, accounting has not evolved to the point where they're marking both sides of the balance sheet. Well, in certain isolated cases they are, but not generally. And then, as you know, on the banking side, and I mean by that the commercial banking side, specifically with respect to accrual assets, there is no mark-to-market. And there's a reason for that, because if there were mark-to-market and there were no liability marks, I think virtually every bank in the country would be insolvent. I can tell you when I went to run a mid-cap bank in the Mid-Atlantic after having been on Wall Street for a while, Mercantile, as I said, one of the best capitalized, most highly reserved banks in the country with probably some of the best credit experience, if I tried to sell our loan portfolio, wiped out, right? And that has to do with the informational inefficiencies in the middle market in particular, because the fact is that we knew those were money good. We knew the borrowers. We knew the credits. We had security in the form of their firstborn, their wife, their house, and everything else they owned. We knew we would be repaid. But if you were to try to market that, you wouldn't get par.
What was the city's exposure to Lehman, both directly or indirectly?
No idea, unfortunately. That was a little bit prior to my time in terms of actually getting involved. I know we had exposure, and I think we managed through it.
and I, my colleague Jane is well versed in accounting. I am not, so I'm going to shortly turn things over to Jane to ask.
I'm sure who will test me as well.
I confess that my colleagues know the story, but I was an accounting major for a short period of time, and then I realized I just don't like
hard.
Accounting.
Right.
And I went into law because accounting wasn't my forte. So.
So I'll do my best.
Some may argue that law is not my forte, too, but I'll reserve judgment on that. Let me ask a few sort of final questions on this. There have been a lot of experts and a lot of academics talk about the interconnectedness of the markets. There's some who say that the markets aren't really interconnected. There are others that say they're very interconnected, and as a result, this is why we had our financial crisis. I'm interested to hear your views on whether the interconnectedness of the marketplace caused or contributed to challenges at Citigroup, and if you could explain what those were.
Well, you know, there are two, I think, sort of very broad questions embedded in that. You know, to take the last one first, I mean, I think there was a perception that Citi was, of course, not surprisingly, an extremely important financial services firm, not only in the U.S., but globally, that the impact of its being, for lack of a better description, disabled, would likely be fairly severe, both as a confidence matter, in terms of the market thinking, my goodness, Citi is vulnerable and could fail, and in terms of the actual impact on other banks in the world, you know, in the U.S. economy, because you're obviously removing a large provider of liquidity and credit to the economy. So I think its interconnectedness was part of what, and I am assuming this, don't know for sure, but I think it's a fair assumption, was part of what moved people to think that it was necessary to provide Citi with assistance, as described. I think the other element of interconnectedness, of course, we touched on, which was this interaction, which has become much more acute than it ever had before in my experience, between certain derivatives markets and the cash markets in terms of CDS spreads and the percent and the impact that had on debt holders and the stock price, and the fact that they seemed to move, as you know, in a correlated but completely opposite directions, which, of course, had a particularly damaging effect, not just on us, but on others. And then to take your very broad question away from Citi, I think the markets are interconnected. And I think if you were to ask a number of us, we would tell you that the biggest and most troubling interconnection, which I know policymakers are thinking about, is how to deal with the derivatives markets. As you know, the over-the-counter derivatives markets are not hugely transparent. There are a number of interconnections that are not as visible to people as I think one would hope. My sense is that there are efforts underway essentially to try to force them onto exchanges or into clearinghouses or to standardize them on a basis which makes it easier for people to see what the exposures are and to see where they sit, and accordingly possibly make it easier to resolve firms if they do get into trouble. Because the biggest problem you have, I think, in terms of resolutions is sorting through, you know, the various counterparty exposures. And as you know, for a whole host of reasons, I'm not sure that the current structure we have is well suited to that. So I subscribe to the notion that the markets are interconnected. I think as it's currently structured, that interconnectedness does pose obstacles to orderly resolutions of firms that are systemically important. But my own sense is that people are beginning to think through how they might reduce the size of that obstacle, at least in terms of addressing the lack of transparency and lack of standardization in the derivatives markets in particular.
But did the interconnectedness of the marketplace contribute to the financial challenges of Citi specifically?
Other than in this interaction between the equity and the CDS markets in particular, not that I can think of, not any differently than it would have anyone else. As I said, my own view, for what it's worth, and I don't know for sure, but I'm inferring that it was part of what informed the judgment on the part of the regulators and the government authorities that providing assistance to Citi made sense because of that interconnectedness. I'm not sure that the interconnectedness itself, you know, had anything to do with Citi's distress.
Mm-hmm. What was the CDS exposure to Citi leading up to the government assistance, and did that cause or contribute to the need for government assistance?
Well, I don't think it was our exposure. I think it was the fact that CDS spreads had moved where they were. I can't remember, but I think they peaked at 600 or 700 over, you know, and at that stage, or at 600 or 700, at that stage, the impact is on other market participants because they look at those spreads and they say, is this someplace where I really want to put my money? And that's not just in terms of wholesale funding. That's with people who also have deposits with us at various points, some governmental institutions or other quasi-governmental entities who are obviously subject to some, they're all subject to fiduciary duty, but you may argue there's special obligations on the part of governmental entities to the extent that they see a firm that's got CDS spreads of 600 versus those who have them at 200. It's a relatively easy choice, and to the extent that that funding gets displaced, that aggravates liquidity issues that may persist. So the impact for us was not in terms of our participation in the market or in terms of our connection to it. It had more to do with the market perception around where our CDS spreads were at that stage.
Understood. It's obviously difficult to ask the what-if type questions, the hypothetical world questions. Those would, as you know from your days at Davis Polk, those usually cause interjections of cause for speculation and the like from counsel. Since we're not in any litigation posture and we are fact-finding and trying to test hypotheses, in your view, what would have happened to Citi had they not received government assistance, either in this first wave or in the subsequent two other waves?
I have not the foggiest idea, right, in the sense that there are so many codependent variables. You know, very difficult to say. Obviously, with the benefit of hindsight, looking at how it did evolve, you know, you'd be silly to say that if we hadn't gotten the first wave, we would have been able to make it. Having said that, not clear to me what alternatives could have been pursued, either as a policy matter or otherwise, or how the market might have evolved in terms of what our fate might have been. So I just don't know. And again, not being evasive, it's just I have no clue, really. It's a very difficult question.
And Mr. Kelly, we had a hearing in January with the CEOs of J.P. Morgan.
I watched.
You watched. they were posed the question, which is a complicated question, but I will pose it to you as well. There's a concept of being too big to fail.
Yep.
Was Citi too big to fail?
Well, I think the judgment that the government made was that there were, whether you lose too big to, use too big to fail as a moniker or not, I think that there were some firms that the government believed were too important to fail. I actually subscribe to that view. I think part of the reason that they came to that conclusion is because they had limited tools at their disposal to deal with it otherwise. You had a Fed, which I think it's fair to say had 19th century tools in the context of a 21st century crisis, limited ability to deal with it. You've got that combined with resolution authorities that, as you know, are inadequate, and a bankruptcy code which is not necessarily friendly to an orderly resolution. So if you were to ask me for my personal view, not a Citi view,
sure,
I do think that too big to fail as a policy is not a good one, but I think it is equally bad to allow firms that are big and interconnected and important to fail in a disorderly fashion. And I think what people are working towards is trying to come up with a resolution mechanism so that firms, even if they are important systemically, can in fact be resolved in an orderly way.
There is some suggestion that having the moniker too big to fail, either explicitly or implicitly, creates an advantage in the marketplace. There was a perception to some extent in the marketplace in 2008 that some firms may have been too big to fail.
Didn't help.
I was going to ask you about that. what was, in your view, and I appreciate some of these views are your own views.
Absolutely.
But what was your perception of the effect of having that view, of firms having the view in the marketplace that they were too big to fail? The perception by others in the marketplace that certain firms, financial services firms, were too big to fail.
Well, you know, what was interesting about that, Brad, a couple of different things, right? Too big to fail has been around for a very, very long time, as you know. And I think the Fed's policy for at least as long as I've been a professional was one of constructive ambiguity. We're not going to tell you whether you're too big to fail or not, but we're going to let the market guess. And, you know, if it makes sense, we're open if they're going to intervene and take care of it. But it's perfectly possible we may not. My recollection is the only time that they did so expressly, although I can also tell you as a market participant, my own sense is they've done it quietly from time to time, was in Continental, Illinois, where they concluded that for whatever reasons, and as you know, the scale of Continental, Illinois relative to where we are today is just remarkably different, but they did intervene and they did resolve Continental, Illinois in a way that was not a classic resolution, but in fact was open bank assistance, and they resolved it in an orderly way because their concern was that it would have a systemic impact if they didn't. We then went through a period where basically the failures, if you will, were of relatively smaller firms. We went through the thrift crisis, no reason really to call it into question, although, as you know, there were some banks that were troubled in the early 90s and were very large and perceived to be important, but I think the Fed, through other mechanisms, whether it was rates or the provision of liquidity to the market or just a fortuitous turn in the economy, we're able to work our way through that. We've had shocks over the years, 98 with long-term capital management, where the fact is the market shut pretty tightly for a couple weeks around that failure, but reopened quickly enough so that nobody was really threatened. I think there's been discussion about various firms being in trouble as a liquidity matter during the 90s, but the regulators being able to handle it quietly. So the first time ultimately that we've gotten to a real test was in 2008. I think part of what happened was that after Bear, there was some confidence in the market that in fact the government would, from the market standpoint, intervene and ultimately ensure that there was some kind of orderly resolution. Then I think if things became more severe, Fannie and Freddie, the decision to let Lehman go, that certainty subsided. In other words, people said, my goodness, not entirely clear that they are going to do that. So there was a guessing game about who was and who wasn't. But as you know, the way markets work, if there's a live possibility that you are not or that nobody is, they're clearly going to test that. And you found circumstances, as I'm sure you've seen, where they were sort of testing it firm by firm to see whether, in fact, they were going to be taken care of or not. Merrill, as you know, was acquired by B of A, which made that question moot. Then Goldman and Morgan Stanley became bank holding companies, which helped them. Part of the process was obviously doing the capital injections, which seemed to confirm it. But then the question was, which always happens, and you've seen this in the currency crisis in the 90s, for example, the market will always test to find out where the limits are and how far it is that the government's willing to go. So part of what happened during 08 was that there was some perception that there were firms too big to fail, but the market wasn't sure. Tried to find out, and obviously it drove the government to limits in some respects to test the proposition that there were. I think that in part explains why my flip comment about why it didn't help. I don't think it helped because nobody was sure. So in a curious way, constructive ambiguity persisted. It was obviously resolved almost a case-by-case basis, but it was that case-by-case resolution that effectively gave rise to the same constructive ambiguity that the regulators have been working with for years. It was just much more systemic in this case.
True. And the failure of Lehman, what effect did that have then on the perception of
panic? I mean, the fact is that I think if you look back, and like you, there's a cottage industry in books about the period. I've read lots of them, not all of them. But I think if there is one common theme that comes through from virtually everybody is that Lehman was a mistake. Whether it was a mistake in the broadest sense from a policy standpoint, I think is open to question. Whether it was a mistake as an immediate matter in terms of its market impact, I think is pretty clear. It unsettled the market. It certainly, for a while, made things worse. And that generated, as I said, you know, the greater anxiety, which ultimately led to some more disquiet in the markets. Truth is, as I said, the regulators, I think, and the government were handicapped by a variety of deficits as a policy matter. Treasury doesn't have guarantee authority. The Fed doesn't have guarantee authority. Only entity with guarantee authority is the FDIC. You know, clearly limits around the Treasury's ability, which is why they needed the statute, or the Feds, for that matter, to make essentially capital investments in firms. So their resolution authority that was inadequate. So we confronted a crisis which really was genuinely unprecedented. My own view, probably the worst in history. Without having been able to think through at the outset what it is that we would need to cope with that, I think in part because it was just so unanticipated. Look, I told you I had a window onto what I thought might happen. What happened was 1,000 times worse.
To what extent did Citigroup's super senior positions and CDOs precipitate or add to the need for government assistance?
Well, insofar as it was sort of the triggering point, in terms of those exposures we had, and as I said, in terms of the creation of the initial perception of vulnerability, it was obviously a part of it. I think in the event, very difficult to quantify, other than the fact that, as I said, it generated this perception of our vulnerability to additional losses. And part of the reason is, you know, that we structured the deal that we did with the government. And this is an important point. Just, you know, the $20 billion that they provided us, we never asked for it. That showed up on Sunday. We're happy to have it, but we never asked for it. What we had originally proposed was something that was very similar to Wachovia, because that was fresh in our minds, and frankly, we had developed it. And that, as you know, was around, or at least our initial conception of it, was around cutting off the perception of tail risk in the market. In other words, we will get a guarantee against this $300 billion of assets that will give the market comfort that catastrophic risk has been taken off the table. So to the extent that the CDO, super senior CDO exposure had generated a perception of further marks, we were trying basically to put a limit on those marks. And that's why we structured the way we did. Interestingly, none of those securities ended up in the asset, they're in the ring fence, so for other reasons.
And there were several markdowns that Citi did with respect to its positions. And we're working through the documents, and we've asked for documents concerning where things are, and so I'm sure we'll get to the precise numbers, but can you tell me what ultimately the effect of the super senior positions were on Citi and Citi's balance sheet?
I can't. I don't know. And as I said, it was not, you know, through this process, wasn't involved in it. I mean, I could go back and look, just as I'm sure everybody else is, but I just wasn't involved in it. I know it was substantial, but I don't know the particulars of it.
And some of the exposure that Citi's had with respect to subprime, in particular the CDOs, I understand, may be marked up, or excuse me, I'm probably not using the correct accounting term.
I mean, the fact is that I think in the third quarter of this year in particular, I think there was some...
Fourth quarter,
I'm sorry. Precisely. Yeah, there were some... there were markups in the special asset pool. Obviously, that just reflects the fact that markets are recovering, that liquidity is by degrees coming back into the market, which allows people to focus more, as we discussed earlier, on sort of underlying values as opposed to the distress value of those assets. But again, I'm familiar with it, but not immersed in the details of it.
One of our many mandates is rating agencies, and to look at the effect of rating agencies on the financial crisis.
Sure.
And I do appreciate, Mr. Kelly, your views in terms of the general marketplace as well as Citi. But my question, at least initially here, is what effect did ratings have on the challenges that Citi faced throughout the financial crisis?
I don't know that it had any specific effect. And again, understanding the role that I played and where I was, I wouldn't know particularly what our interactions were with the agencies or what specific impact it had with us. I think it's fair to say, and everybody knows this, that clearly there were securities that were perceived to be super senior AAA plus that ultimately didn't work out. Rating agencies obviously reach those conclusions based on their own analysis. I think it's fair to say if you look back ex post, there were clearly some mistakes that were made. Having said that, I'm not sure that those mistakes are wildly different from the mistakes that market participants made in terms of how they thought about the future. In other words, things that were completely unanticipated actually crystallized, and that had an impact. The rating agencies, as you know, are something that are embedded in a variety of statutes and are an inherent part of the market. I think it's clear to say that they had some stumbles as we've gone through this, but that doesn't make them any different from any other market participant in that respect. But in connection with its specific impact on Citi, I can't address it. I'm really addressing that more or less as a market observer. I've also joked that I understand it's a problem, and I have thought about it a fair amount, but I have no creative or ingenious view about how you might fix it. It's a problem.
With respect to rating agencies specifically, did the subscriber-based model have any impact with respect to Citi? You mentioned that you didn't believe that rating agencies had an effect on
Citi-specific.
This question is, again, Citi-specific, but did, with respect to the type of model that was used, I assume that same answer would be no.
It precisely would be industry-wide as opposed to Citi-specific, and I wouldn't know if it did with respect to Citi anyway, but as I said, I mean, I think these were industry-wide phenomena.
Risk management has been a topic of discussion with respect to the financial crisis as a whole.
Yeah.
Question is did concerns over risk management at Citi cause or contribute to the need for Citi to have government assistance?
Not specifically, you know, that I'm aware of. As I said, it's hard to separate risk management from the fact that we had the exposures, which in fact generated the perception of vulnerability, so I'm not suggesting that. But having only arrived in February of 2008, I have no idea how risk was managed on sort of a particularized level at Citi, but I have my more general view, which you've heard me suggest, which is that there were a lot of events in the market that were completely unanticipated, outside the models, outside people's reasonable expectation, that clearly did violence to expectations, not only here, but also across the street. I will say, you know, that as a unifying principle in terms of thinking about what happened here, I think in many respects it was just not just here, but across the street, it was a good old-fashioned failure of credit judgment. I think the fact is that there were some decisions that were made, you know, with the benefit of hindsight and, frankly, even in some respects with the benefit of foresight across the industry, where people made some credit decisions that clearly they came to regret.
Mr. Kelly, you occupy a unique position in the sense that you came into the situation somewhat after the fact. But have you, since joining Citi, developed any views concerning any lessons learned, Citi-specific, that could have avoided the challenges that Citi faced in 2007 and 2008?
Yeah, again, and it's important. I think, yes, they are city-specific, but to the point, I think they're also more broadly applicable. Mm-hmm. We went through an extended period in the U.S., as I said, where liquidity and capital were by and large free. I think in some respects that lulled people to sleep a little bit. And obviously during a period of protracted low rates, people began to reach for yield since short funding was readily available and you felt you could invest that on a mismatch basis with relatively little anxiety. I think that that was a very common practice. I mentioned or analogized the sieves, the banks, but I think there were a lot of financial firms that were sieve-like in the sense that they were short-funded and invested long, and in the context of a liquidity crunch, ultimately you find yourself in very dire straits. I think if there is a lesson learned, it is one that was taught to me when I was a very young lawyer at Davis Polk doing bank due diligence, which is you die short. You know, and if there's any lesson from this crisis, it is that you've got to be sure that your liability structure is solid enough and long enough to give you the staying power necessary to weather whatever it is the market might have to offer.
Mr. Kelly, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you the question that we've been tasked to investigate by Congress, the central question, and that is the causes of the financial crisis. That's not a city-specific question, but certainly city was a market participant during the financial crisis. In your view, what were the causes of the financial crisis? And I know that there would be treatises written on this for years, and we certainly are investigating those. But centrally, what do you view as the causes of the financial crisis?
Well, you know, what's interesting about that, and I had mentioned this to E.J. and Brad at one point, when I was a very young lawyer, one of the things that I was sent off to do was to look at the origins and legislative history of Glass-Steagall. And as you know, part of what drove Glass-Steagall was the Depression and banking crisis in the late 20s and the early 30s. Having spent more or less a year and a half in the library, I came up with a list of the stated causes of the Depression, which was 2 pages, single-spaced bullet points. I suspect that what's going to happen is that we'll have a similar analysis of what happened here in terms of the contributing factors. Very difficult to focus on any one in particular because markets are complicated things and there were a number of things that converged to create this. But for me at least, what it highlighted again, and this was true in the Depression as well, and I think the Chairman Bernanke's made this clear, is that liquidity is absolutely crucial to the functioning of the world economic system and the system in the United States. To the extent liquidity disappears for whatever reason, and liquidity is hugely dependent on confidence, the impact is dire. So you had the absence of deposit insurance in the late 20s, early 30s, lots of small banks, they all failed, huge contraction in the money supply, Fed didn't act, made matters worse, right? Because to the extent there was less money and less liquidity out there, asset prices were going to fall, ended up aggravating the situation. In some respects, even though it's 80 years later and it's a much more sophisticated economy, ultimately the immediate cause of this was liquidity. People basically lost faith. To your point, there was a crisis of confidence. They were no longer willing to believe. They were no longer willing to take risk. And as a result, given that broad uncertainty, they were unwilling to make decisions that in the past people had made in the normal course every single day, which had a huge impact given the fact that it all happened simultaneously on the system as a whole. In terms of what led to that loss of confidence, which is really the broader question, I really don't know. You know, I I'm not sure that anybody does, but I could probably list, you know, 6 or 7 factors that were contributors. I think a protracted era of low rates, you know, and not to be flip about it, but when rates are 1%, everybody's a genius. You know, it's impossible not to make money by levering. I think the fact that there was a bubble that evolved and the impression generally was that housing prices in the U.S. were going to continue to rise, and because fixed income investors in light of those low rates had an appetite for yield, you were able to provide funding to people who would have been deemed to be less creditworthy in prior periods. The fact that even though the mortgages that would have been less creditworthy ended up being dispersed by virtue of the sophistication of the financial system into a variety of instruments and there was no transparency as to where they resided or who held them, that generated anxiety, lack of confidence with respect to who your counterparties could be. So not surprisingly, and I'm only, you know, a third of the way through the list if you pressed me, but It's very difficult to pinpoint, but at the end of the day, it seems to me that the inquiry has to be what factors contributed to that, to such an erosion in confidence that it ultimately led to a seizure of the credit markets. And that's a very complicated question, and one that I wish I were competent to answer, but I'm not.
Given your reference to Glass-Steagall, I have to ask you, Graham Leach Bliley, cause or contribute to the financial crisis, would that be on your list?
No, because in the absence of it, in other words, assume Graham Leach Bliley never happened, this all could have happened. So I think it's, by and large, in my own view, sort of unrelated.
Thank you. My colleague Jane has several more specific and fine-tuned questions than my inartful questions. And I defer to Jane now to ask you about some specifics.
First, I'd like to go back and clarify a few things that you discussed with Brad just to educate myself a little bit better. One of the things that I'm paraphrasing, if I'm not saying this correctly, please correct me.
Sure.
You said that when there was pressure on Citi's stock price, that your debt holders had gotten nervous.
Yeah.
And that would cause your debt funding to be less secure. So
sure.
Could you elaborate on that?
Sure.
I don't understand it.
If depositors obviously had the perception that the firm is troubled as reflected in the equity price, they might very well choose to withdraw funding. So they take their deposits out, they don't roll their credit that they have with us. It magnifies the liquidity crisis that was going on in the market generally.
So you're referring to customer deposits,
sure.
Which I would understand,
yeah.
And short-term funding, but
absolutely.
There's not, would there be any long-term funding or medium-term funding that would have any provisions?
Well, they don't have an exit. It's just that the price of it goes up. So your ability to replace, if you will, the short funding, given the fact that it's dried up, is much less because the long funding markets, if the short funding markets are closed as well.
Right. Okay. One of the other things that you mentioned was on the capital ratios.
Yeah.
That you said that the tier one capital, that you were fine and healthy on that. People were focusing on
TCE.
I'm curious if you have a view on whether Citigroup and Citibank, each individually, would have been able to clear the Tier 1 capital requirements without the government funding.
Absolutely. Remember, the Tier 1 capital requirements, my recollection is, were 4 and 8 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
My further recollection, I may be wrong, Jenny, you have to go back and check this, I think our Tier 1 ratio in November of 2008 was like 11-ish, if I'm not mistaken.
It was 10-8.
Yeah. So it was well in excess of the minimum. The tension that you see, the tension is this, right? In other words, it depends on one's point of view, right? Are you running a bank for the bondholders and the depositors, or are you running a bank for the equity? I think what the regulators have concluded and what they thought about historically was they didn't care about whether you were running a bank for the equity. They cared about whether you were running a bank to generate security for the depositors and the bondholders, because that was, your funding was crucial for all the reasons that we've described. What happened was that the feedback loop, which I don't think was as true historically, between the equity markets and the fixed income markets became much tighter. And what that was reflected in was in the relationship, again, as we discussed, between the CDS markets and what people saw in our spreads and the equity market price began to unsettle people in the fixed income markets. And the only way to stop the stock price from falling, because clearly shorts don't go in for no reason, mm-hmm. was by virtue of having something that the equity believed would be left for it. So preferred stock, for example, is there to absorb losses and to protect bondholders and depositors, but it does the common stock no good at all. So the regulators historically have been focused on the entire capital structure, you know, including preferred stocks and subordinated debt, for example, so long as it was loss-absorbing. What happened was the market, the common stock market, said, that's interesting, but we don't care, you know, what's left for us. So if you actually look at our ratios pre and post, you'll find that our Tier 1 ratio, notwithstanding the fact that we now have a Tier 1 common ratio, which is, I think, 8.2 at pro forma for the first quarter, given some other issues, has increased dramatically. Our Tier 1 ratio is basically flat. So what we did was to take some of what people, what we knew to be, and what the regulators thought to be, loss-absorbing capital, and we converted it to common stock. So the preferred exchange we did last summer, $58 billion, that was essentially preferred stock and trust-preferred securities that became common. And then the common equity offering we did this past December. And as you know, the conversion of the government's preferred to common back in early 2009 generated more common equity, which in turn stabilized the stock price. But it didn't change the capital ratios from the standpoint of the regulators. Now, in fairness, clearly there were increases associated with those injections. My basic point is that if you look at Tier 1, it's been pretty constant. It's the equity measures, the TCE and the Tier 1 common, that have varied. But the great news is that we were able to use that Tier 1 capital that we had and convert that to equity, which in turn helped to stabilize the stock price. Huge dilution, obviously, but it gave the common equity holders more hope, if you will, that they would have a stake in the firm. And that, in turn, I think, quiets the debt markets because you cut that feedback loop. Sorry, that was so long-winded and complicated.
When the government assistance was originally negotiated, the loss sharing arrangement or the ring fence arrangement, that was, I think you said that that was struck on a prototype of what you had thought about for Wachovia, is that correct?
Yeah.
And can you just tell us, like, what transpired? How was it that the deal was struck? You spoke to short story.
Well, you know, in one respect, from our standpoint, it is, because I can tell you that I had the one conversation. I think, as I've told others, the New York Fed was on the phone. Now Secretary Geithner was on the phone very briefly because his nomination was announced that afternoon, so we didn't talk to him anymore, and he didn't participate. So it was essentially first the New York Fed. I can't remember whether anybody from Washington was on the phone, and then the New York Fed evolved into New York Fed, Washington Fed, OCC, FDIC, Treasury. They said, okay, what do you want to do, more or less? We are in a position where we believe we need to do something. What would you suggest? We went back to them, as I recall, that Friday night, or if not Saturday morning, with a proposal that was very similar to the Wachovia proposal in terms of the ring fence and the loss sharing agreement. I remember having a conference call with them on Saturday about it. It was essentially what we'd served up, I think, was by and large one page. It had expected loss is associated with it, had the assets described, the amount of assets, suggested what the loss sharing arrangement would be and what our first loss would be in light of those expected losses. There was some conversation back and forth, and then there were a number of conversations during the course of the weekend that were sort of one-offs, and we didn't really hear back conclusively, again, my recollection, until late on Sunday, and at that stage they came back to us, if you will, with a revised term sheet with some variations in the ring fence or loss sharing agreement, and with a proposal that they inject a further $20 billion in preferred stock.
And again, just to confirm, this, in your view, was to stabilize people's views of Citi,
and
stabilize the stock price.
And the ring fence had the effect of cutting off that perceived tail risk. But the other important thing to remember about it was that it also increased our capital ratios in the following sense. We got the 20, but we also got asset weighting relief with respect to the assets that were covered by the ring fence. In other words, irrespective of what their risk weights were for regulatory purposes, they were deemed to be weighted at 20%. So my recollection at the time is that we got $16 billion of capital relief for that, combined with the $20 billion that we got as an injection. That was $36 billion. And then I think we were able to count the $7 billion that we paid, in other words, that we issued to them in connection with that loss sharing. We were able to count on a market base about $4 billion of that as an insurance premium. So it increased our capital by $40 billion.
Tier 1.
Tier 1. And that's why we were willing, that's why we did it. we didn't actually think, and in the event, as you know, we never got close to breaching the first loss, which was ultimately $30 billion and $9 billion in reserves. I think the ultimate losses we had before we unwound it were sort of $9 billion over five quarters. We did it because of the capital relief issue and the notion that it would enhance the view of our capital ratios in the markets and therefore help to stabilize the firm in conjunction with eliminating the tail risk. But remember, it was a $39 billion first loss, so it wasn't, we still had lots of exposure potentially.
So the losses ultimately on the first loss
were not nine.
It was only nine. Okay. And so let me go back to my question on the capital, because maybe I don't understand. If you got $40 billion
in capital,
and then increased your Tier 1, you would still think that through the end of 2008, if you used December 31, 08 as a marker, that you would still have satisfied the minimum requirements. Would you have satisfied the well-capitalized requirements?
I don't know. I'd have to go back and look, but I think our Tier 1 would have still been adequate. I'm pretty sure that's true, but I don't know for sure, but that would be my recollection.
At the bank and at Citigroup?
Oh, yeah. The bank was, frankly, always fine. You know, the issue was at the group level. That's commonly true in bank holding company structures. The banks are always more adequately capitalized than the holding companies, by and large.
So then the...
But again, don't hold me to that. I want to go back and verify it. And my basic point was that we had lots of Tier 1 all through this process, obviously enhanced by what it is that we did with the government. But the market didn't care, right? The market at that stage tended to be more focused on the tangible common issue.
Also, at the time you were negotiating the exchange agreement and the ring fence arrangement, did Citi project, this was in late November, right? Did Citi project what losses you would expect to incur through the end of that year? Level 8.
With respect to those assets?
With respect to those assets.
Yeah, we did.
And more broadly?
No.
Would you
at
project?
At least I did. In other words, in terms of what I was working with, we had a $300 billion pool of assets, which changed markedly, you know, during the course of the negotiations. Mm-hmm. But we did have an expected loss. We had reserves against it. And I can't remember right off the top of my head. I think the expected lifetime loss was $18 billion, and we may have had $9 billion of reserves against it. I think, Brad, I can't. Don't hold me to that. But we did. We showed them what we believe the losses to be in those assets for purposes of calculating what a first loss might be. And then the view was we'd have loss sharing beyond that.
Okay. I think you mentioned earlier the soup senior, the CDOs where you had soup senior exposure. Were those in the ring fence assets? Were they? Did you inspect them to be originally, and they were never in?
Well, what happened, and it's again, it's something that unfortunately is not simple. What happened was that the way the ring fence ended up being structured ended up being very unfriendly to mark-to-market assets. So as a result, the ring fence was almost exclusively accrual assets.
What do you mean by the ring fence became unfriendly to mark-to-market assets? I don't follow that.
Okay, well, I'll try to explain this, and it's going to be difficult. But in any event, we have a $39 billion first loss, right? We have the Treasury, I think, and PJ or Brad will correct me, the Treasury, I think, has the next five, right? Mm-hmm. The FDIC has the next 10, and the Fed then has the rest of it. You know, in terms of the losses. So it's 39, 5, 10, 90, 10. You've got to do the math, but essentially that gets you to somewhere like $56 billion. Then beyond $56 billion, the Fed has it. The Fed is not in the form of a guarantee. The Fed is in the form of a non-recourse loan. And what became apparent was that we had thought about this of, we lose money, you pay us. The Fed was, we're not going to lose any money. So whatever gains or losses are embedded in these assets, we're going to share in those. So if there's a gain in an asset, that's going to offset whatever loss there is that we've incurred on any other asset. So if you put mark-to-market securities in, which we believed had higher fundamental value, if you will, than was currently reflected in the market, we were going to be deprived of the gain in terms of the erosion of the liquidity premium over time. So that would go to the Fed rather than to us. And that made no economic sense to us. So what we did was to go in with accrual assets, right, that had no marks associated with them. They only had reserves associated with them, but they were easier to deal with and made more sense economically. And you may find that I think the reason that B of A ultimately concluded that they would not execute their ring fence agreement is because they had lots of mark-to-market assets in there, and they concluded that it didn't make any sense.
Let me just restate what I think you said. Would that help my colleagues? So you have the accrual assets, and you have mark-to-market assets. If the mark-to-market assets went in the ring fence, anything, any losses you share according to the arrangement, but also any gains.
Any gains, remember, whether because it was going to be on a net basis.
It was on a net basis. And your perception was that the mark-to-market assets had more, I'm using the term intrinsic value, but not in the classic term, more intrinsic value than they were, the fair value they were stated
at. I think we estimated
the
liquidity premium on the assets that we put in there originally, and again, don't hold me to this, but it's directionally right. I think we thought there was like $23 billion worth of liquidity premium that was embedded in those assets that we put in there. So given the way the deal was ultimately structured, that's 23 that we would be giving back, if you see what I'm saying.
So you saw upside to those assets.
Yeah, absolutely.
So don't put them in.
Precisely.
Okay. And so that begs the question, what's happened with the assets that might have gone in, the ones we're referring to, the mark-to-market assets?
I think by and large those marks have held up pretty well. I mean, I think our subsequent marks in the mark-to-market securities have been pretty modest. In fact, as we just pointed out, there have been some markups associated with those assets as the markets have recovered. But the reason we put, going back to it, just not to put too fine a point on it, is accrual assets, as you know, are held at par, net of reserves. Downside is downside, but there is no upside, if you see what I'm saying.
Right.
Is it fair? This subject, by the way, is incredibly complex. So that what you're getting, even though Ned has got a better grasp of it than anybody else, and what you're getting is about 2% of it. Mm-hmm. But is it fair? And I really don't know the answer to this. Is it fair to say that the government also liked this? Because, as in general, it was getting the accrual assets it were getting had a less tail risk than the.
I think that's fair. Absolutely.
So that what was happening is the government was also pressing us at the time, as I recall, to put these accrual assets into the ring fence because it was minimizing. They were taking the tail risk. And it was minimizing the tail risk.
Oh, so they were taking the longer term, further out tail risk.
Yeah, we had the first
this
whatever.
Is all
we
tail
had,
risk.
We had the, we have right. We basically had the first 39 plus 10% of the rest.
Okay. So
they had 90% of the rest.
So the government was trying to get the safest possible assets into.
Yeah.
We announced the deal, and then we had to go negotiate it. And part of the negotiation was what goes into the pool. And the government wanted the safest possible assets to protect the taxpayers. Because they were taking the tail risk. It turned out that the economics were such that we wanted the accrual-based assets, and it turned out to be
consistent with what they
consistent
wanted.
Consistent with what
well.
The government wanted.
Well, while we're on that topic of the negotiation, who from Citi was involved in negotiating that?
Principally myself and Brian Leach.
Anyone else?
Yeah, Gary Crittenden was around. You know, Vikram certainly had conversations. Michael Helfer, you know, was our general counsel, was having conversations. But then Brian had a team, obviously, working with him who may have had conversations at various points with the New York Fed, but that was the team.
Was Mr. Rubin involved either directly or indirectly in these negotiations?
Not that I'm aware of.
Could you tell us, broad brush, you commented that the assets that you originally had scope that you thought would go into the ring fence ended up being something quite different at the end.
Yeah.
We've talked broadly accrual assets versus mark-to-market assets, but Is there more to it than that?
Sure. Because there were TARP limitations, Fed prudential limitations that weren't just prudential, but in some cases statutory. So there was a whole series of filters, right, that were imposed as we went through the negotiation because, remember, we did this in a two-page term sheet over 2 days, had a high-level agreement, and then we hadn't implemented. I don't think the agreement was executed. BJ, correct me if I'm wrong, until mid-January maybe.
Six weeks later.
But the documents, and then the asset selection, I think, was going through the summer.
What I was thinking. Right. Asset selection took forever.
Right, because of these filters. So no asset that was originated past, I can't remember, March 26th. It was the date in TARP, March 26th, 2008, or whatever the number was.
It was the date. They were foreign versus domestic.
Then the Fed basically would not take security in foreign assets.
The list that's included in the agreement.
Yes,
there's
precisely.
A very
those
long
filters.
List, and then you've
exactly.
mentioned the first
no
three
equities.
Or four, three of the
right.
first four that are relatively
right.
straightforward, but
precisely.
It's everything that's in that list.
Exactly.
Which would require you to go down asset by asset to make sure everything cleared all those fences.
I think we ended up throwing out, I don't know, north of $80 billion in assets, as I recall, you know, just in terms of various substitutions.
Because when you did the initial...
They didn't pass the filters.
Yeah, they did the initial pass. It would be based on an aggregate...
Right. And see, we weren't anticipating because we didn't know. We didn't understand how the Fed was going to structure the back end. Remember, it's a non-recourse loan. Fed has limitations on its authority of what they can lend against. So that drove some of the filters. The statute, TARP, drove some of the other filters. So what we were doing was operating on the assumption, which turned out to be wrong, that effectively Treasury and the FDIC would be providing the guarantees. The Fed showed up on the back end when... We didn't know they were, if you see what I'm saying. Remember, the Fed wasn't involved in Wachovia. That was an FDIC guarantee for which we paid.
So let me understand a little bit better. We have the list of the hurdles that the assets have to clear in the arrangement.
Yeah.
But the term sheet was struck, it was a couple of pages, and the date the term sheet was struck was what versus
November,
the date that the agreement was finally signed was
November,
what?
I think the November 23rd or 24th was the date of the term sheet, and I think the agreement, I may be wrong, but my recollection is the agreement was signed. It may have been signed, I think the capital injection I know was December 31st. Maybe we signed the agreement December 31st. I just can't, but it was later.
Yeah.
For some reason, I thought it was January 15th, but I may be wrong.
No, I think
I may be
right.
But December 31st.
December 31st.
Yeah.
So that's why you had one group of assets in mind and another group of assets.
And then, remember, we signed the agreement without having determined the assets. I think the agreement itself suggested that there would be a review of the assets and a final determination of the list, which I think actually ultimately slipped into August.
It was certainly the summer.
Yeah.
It was a huge task. I mean, there were dozens of people involved. I wasn't personally involved, but I remember the magnitude of the task. It was consuming.
Was Mr. Karp involved, or?
I was hanging outside near the basket.
Right. Well, you were nodding your head, Mr. Karp, and I was wondering if you were involved.
It was an immense task, is the point, you know, because as you might imagine, $300 billion in assets, an awful lot of individual loans, and you've got to go through and figure out whether they pass the filters or not. So we had discussions, for example, about whether a nominal foreign obligor guaranteed by a U.S. entity would count, right? So Ford Motor Company's got a subsidiary in the U.K. If it's a subsidiary loan guaranteed by Ford Motor Company, does it get in or does it not?
Okay.
My recollection is it got thrown out. I can't remember. Even though it seemed to us it's obviously U.S. credit. We're lending on the strength of the U.S. parent, but because it was to a foreign obligor, no good.
Understand.
Yeah.
But when you when the ring fence arrangement was sized, did Citi suggest the size?
Yes.
And you had some view on which assets broadly would be.
Well, we had
included?
Two views. One is we were frankly again. You have to keep in mind that we're doing all this very quickly, right? So the size actually was very similar to Wachovia. I think Wachovia was 300. This was 306. We went through asset categories that we thought might fit, backed into that number, and in part were driven by how much would be enough to give the market comfort that we have, in fact, eliminated that tail risk. There was not a huge amount of science in coming to that number.
Okay. Why was the Wachovia? Wachovia was 300, 306. I don't think of Wachovia as being an equivalent to Citigroup, why then use the ring fence equivalent for Wachovia as the model?
Well, as we look through it, and again, thinking about it, we were thinking about our exposures, how much would we need to persuade the market that we'd eliminated tail risk, and it was coincident in one respect, but it triangulated to about 300 billion. In Wachovia, we'd actually done, to the extent that we could over the course of 3 days, a pretty detailed analysis of Wachovia's portfolio. Remember, they had 120 billion in option arms. They had an awful lot of commercial real estate. They had some other structured securities, and we actually had come to the conclusion there that it was 300 billion. But remember, that was a much larger percentage of Wachovia's balance sheet than 300 was of ours. So 300 Wachovia, I think, in a balance sheet, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was probably a trillion at the time, so that was 30% of the balance sheet. We were 300 on 2 trillion, so it was 15%. But we were trying to get to a number that was, and again, not a lot of science, but a number that was large enough to persuade the market that we had eliminated tail risk, but not so large as to be impractical.
With regards to the sieves, should I stay away from questions that relate to them coming
Because I wasn't, exactly. Jane, I wasn't here. As I said, I showed up in February of 08. I was here, but in a slightly different role, but still responsible for it in November. But at that point, the die had been cast, and at that stage, it was just an economic decision about what made more sense. Continue to chase it as a mezzanine matter, or actually take the assets in our own balance, in other words, actually buy the assets.
Were you involved? You said you got here in November of 2000.
February
08. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Withdraw that question.
Some of these questions I may have a view on. I'll just confirm with you.
Sure.
Let's see. There were $3.3 billion of losses on the CIV assets in 2008. Were there losses on the CIV assets in any other periods in addition to that, or was that the only losses that you recognized on the CIV assets?
I don't know, but I think, remember, those losses were driven by and large by marks. Would have been most acute in 08. I think they probably, I just don't know. And I can't remember, Jay, I can't remember. Some of those CIV assets may have become held to maturity. In other words, once we took them onto the balance sheet, I'm not positive, but my recollection is that they may have been, which of course would have eliminated the issue around the marks. But I may be wrong, but I just don't know.
Jim, this is publicly disclosed, and you're going to be talking to other witnesses who are familiar with this. We can clear this up with you. And
it may be the held to maturity.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah. Okay. So back on the loss sharing arrangement, were the CIV assets ultimately included in the ring fence?
I don't know.
I'm not recalling the wind down, because there's a wind down. But
I don't think there were any CIV assets in the ring fence.
But I'm not sure.
I'm not positive, but I don't think there were.
Can we clarify whether there is or not?
Sure.
Perhaps. Yeah, Brad, you can get back to us separately, and just that would be helpful. Thank you.
And the public filings refer to the CIVs being wound down. Can you explain to us what you mean by winding the CIVs down?
Just
so the CIV assets come on the books, and there were some liabilities still standing that also came on the books of Citi?
We would have paid off the liability.
We paid off all the liabilities.
Right, so in other words, we owned the assets. And at that stage, there are two ways to wind it down. One is through sales. The second is obviously just through organic runoff, because they had an average life associated with them. I think it was all term debt. I think the fact is that it was relatively short, even though it was much longer than the funding we had. But a lot of financial institution papers we discussed. So I think that it's the wind down essentially is, we're obviously not reinvesting any proceeds. We are going to let this portfolio run off naturally and hopefully facilitate it through sales. And that's why I'm hesitating around the held to maturity, because I'm not sure we did put it held to maturity. I think we probably have, but we can confirm that.
And am I correct to say that there was no Lehman debt in those CIVs?
There was no Lehman debt in the CIVs.
WaMu, as I said, was the only default that I was aware of.
And it remains, I think, to this day, the only.
See, the funny part about the CIVs was that the credit judgment was fabulous.
Right.
It was the funding structure that was the flaw.
clarify my understanding. When perhaps you can tell me how, when you look at city's off-balance sheet business, how would you view that in terms of different buckets? For example, there's CDOs and CLOs. There's mortgage and student loan, credit card securitizations that
which
are more routine.
Just ordinary course. And I think that was the, again, I'm focusing sort of on my time as opposed to what happened before mm-hmm. I got here. But I think those standard financial institution securitizations are the vast majority of what we had off balance sheet. I think with 166, 167, what have we brought back on? 180 billion or so, basically, mm-hmm. which is all sort of consumer securitizations.
Okay, then the CDOs, CLOs, then I have the asset-backed commercial paper conduits that you administer.
They're about, and I think they're 19 or 20, don't hold me to that, but my recollection is they're 19 or 20 or so.
Okay.
Don't know, but you know, that's something we can check.
Third-party commercial paper conduits, single and multi-seller. This is kind of, as I looked across all the off-balance sheet stuff, I'm trying to understand, are these the types of categories, if I would try to categorize the off-balance sheet structures and
yeah.
vehicles that you use,
and
these are the categories.
Yes, and I think we've got fairly extensive disclosure around that. And I think what you just described, if I'm not mistaken, would be in that 180 we just brought back on balance sheet as a result of 166, 167. Mm-hmm. CIVs would have been separate from that because they came back on a while ago, but 166, 167 would have covered, I think, most of those synthetics.
And then the other category being the SIFs.
Yeah, and they were already on.
I think the VIE footnote in the K's actually breaks it down, and Citi, since, frankly, the Enron days, has had a market-leading VIE footnote that actually breaks it down by category and gives a lot of information
yeah.
about
just
buckets.
I wanted to get your take on what I see in the public filings is, in fact, how you would view it. You look at the off-balance sheet stuff, and it falls into those basic categories.
Absolutely.
Okay. And
there was, I think the point that Brad made, you know, look, there was always a lot of, I can remember reading blogs and other things talking about, oh my God, Citi's got, you know, gazillions in off-balance sheet. I remember reacting at the time, silly, right? You know, at the end of the day, it's pretty standard plain vanilla stuff, you know, with certain exceptions, but predominantly it was precisely what it is that you would expect to see.
And you mentioned 166, 167, and in your public filing, you've got the impact on the Citigroup.
Yeah.
But is there any markedly different impact if you look at just the bank?
I think most of those assets are in the bank, or I'm pretty sure they're coming back. I don't know, actually. I take that back. I haven't looked at it in that light, but I take that back. But I wouldn't think so.
Yeah, that would be just interesting for us to know.
Sure. Okay.
Give us a better sense of what assets are in the bank and mm-hmm.
yeah,
what
precisely.
Assets aren't in the bank.
Just to give you rough numbers, you know, I think we have $1.8 trillion now with $2 trillion in assets. My suspicion is that 2/3 of them are in the bank, and roughly 2/3 are in the bank, and the balance is in the holding company and the broker dealer in particular.
And then in 2009, there's what I understand to be the three major card trusts, the Master, Omni, and the Broadway. Can you just elaborate what occurred in 2009? I've read it in the filing, but I'd like if you could just explain that to us.
I don't know. I don't know enough to answer, but I know enough to be dangerous, right, which I think had to do with the OCC at one point, and I think it was pursuant to a regulatory ruling that was, I take it all back. What I'm remembering is that there was either a regulatory rule which caused us to consolidate those trusts. What I can't remember is whether there were anything that we did specifically to support those trusts which caused us to have to consolidate them. But there was about $80 billion, as I remember.
What I believe I read was there was approximately $80
billion. Yeah. And I just can't remember what the trigger was.
Subordinated support provided by city.
Right. Well, that's probably what the trigger was. In other words, we had to step in. We supported the trust, and therefore we were forced to consolidate them.
And it says it impacted your
it would have impacted the balance sheet.
Yeah, no. I thought what I read was it impacted your capital requirements, but it wasn't clear as I read it whether they came on balance sheet. So ultimately, that's my question: is did they actually come on balance sheet?
Well, that's the interesting point. They did for regulatory purposes. In other words, for regulatory capital purposes, but they did not for GAAP purposes. I think until 166, 167.
And these would have been, this is some accounting, more detail. Apologize, I'm trying to keep away from the accounting stuff, but these would have been QSBs?
Don't know.
So my question is, ultimately, if you provided this subordinated funding, why wouldn't, if these are SPEs, why wouldn't this have been a trigger event, a reconsideration event under 1046R?
In terms of bringing it back
up for GAAP
purposes?
If they're QSPEs, it may be because they're QSPEs, and then even then I'd like to better understand. If you the QSP would have been set up in a certain
I think the accounting
fashion.
Guys can walk you through that. I know, again, based on my recollection, and I may be entirely wrong, that they were brought back on for regulatory capital purposes but did not show up on the GAAP balance sheet. That's my recollection. And, in fact, we had to make a capital injection into one of the banks, and I can't remember what City South Dakota or whether it was Citibank NA, in order to compensate for their coming back on.
You're relying on his recollection of accounting issues, which is
right. And I'm just saying that my recollection is back on for regulatory, not for GAAP. Don't remember specifically what the triggering event was, nor do I know why they would have come back on for regulatory and not for GAAP.
Okay. And this is a little bit of a nit. In your disclosure in the 2009 10-K, I believe it's in the footnote where you discuss the SUP senior CDOs and CLOs. In the 2009 filing, you refer to 24 out of 39 of the CDO structures coming on balance sheet between 2007 and 2009. In your prior year filing, 10-K, it's the exact same paragraphs, but it refers to 34 out of 46 coming on between 2007 and 2008. So in 2 years, I took 34 out of 46. In 3 years, I took 24 out of 39 on. So I'm confused by the disclosure.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't follow exactly, but we have sold some of these things.
What I was wondering, if some of them have been sold, so they're not included in the
They could have
numbers.
Sold, or they presumably some of them could have matured, less likely, but they could have sold.
Finished.
Yeah,
They're running
actually,
off.
Actually, no. Some of them.
I think some
of them wound up.
Some of the 03 ones had a 6-year tenure.
Oh, the
real
ones.
So,
yes. That's right. Yeah, the theoretically, these things have 20-year lives, but in fact, they have
the
6-year lives.
The actual tenure is between 5 and 20 years.
But we did, we have, you're going to talk to Brian, right?
And tomorrow.
Brian will be able, is more likely to say, but we've, opportunistically, when there's a good price for these things, we're selling. So,
I think it might be helpful for us to understand comparative numbers. So through 2009, on the same basis as the numbers that were presented in the 2008 10-K, out of the total 46, how many came on? And then we know some of those either were matured or sold.
Right, and there's
so
a distinction. The super senior positions, to the extent the company retained them back when the deals were done, were already on balance sheet. So this is a reconsideration event, potentially, depending on what happened.
These would be reconsideration
bringing the entire
events.
Structure
yeah,
on.
Bringing the whole structure on, I understand.
And just for housekeeping purposes, I know Mr. Leach has been designated to talk about the same topic, and I probably should have asked at the outset again, and I apologize. What areas is he designated to talk about that may be different from Mr. Kelly, or is there?
Well, he's a chief risk officer.
Correct.
Yes. And Brian was involved in a bunch of these negotiations, but more on as opposed to negotiating the deal, as it were. He was focused on the assets, the risk analysis, what we could put in, what made sense to put in, and his team was involved in the ultimate selection of the assets that went into the ring fence. And then Brian took over as chief risk officer, I think, about the same time I arrived at the firm, February of 08. So he clearly inherited lots of this and let us work through it over
so
the last
couple
of years.
So it's very marking valuation of these assets.
Thank you.
Could you, to the best of your ability, could you describe for me the differences between your role and the chief risk officer's role, so that we can understand?
They're entirely different. I think the simplest way to think about it is Brian's chief risk officer, I'm the deal guy. I'm your classic investment banker. Who's had other roles in his life, but
formerly a lawyer,
precisely, and formerly, you know, I ran a commercial bank. But that's the difference. In other words, what I, and I think you know this, what I do is deal with a set of facts, try and figure out what they are, and then ultimately come up with a structure that satisfies both parties.
Okay. And how would you describe the risk officers?
Well, I mean, to BJ's point, you know, he's clearly involved in setting standards around the assumption of risk, risk limits, how it is that we think about the valuation of assets, how they are being valued on the desk, whether it makes sense optimally to sell this asset or that, this asset or that asset, works very closely with the business people in assessing all of those things.
Okay.
I have a couple more, and that's... You alluded, Mr. Kelly, earlier to reading books on topics, and I do confess that I have read a couple on the topic of the financial crisis, and one of which was Mr. Paulson's book, Secretary Paulson's book, and he describes in his book a telephone call that he received from Mr. Robert Rubin on or about November 18th, which then prompted a conversation between the Secretary and the President, President Bush, on November 19th. Then, of course, on November 23rd was when the government assistance with respect to Citi was announced. My question is, did you have a role in preparing or briefing Mr. Rubin for this November 18th call to Secretary Paulson, to the extent that it took place? I'm not attesting to the veracity or the date of that call. It's only what I've read. But did you have a role in briefing Mr. Rubin for a call or conversation with Secretary Paulson?
No. And I have, to your point, I have no idea whether it occurred. First time I got involved in what in the run-up, I mean, intimately involved in what we were talking about was that Friday afternoon, as I described, when I was called down and asked to participate in that conference call.
Mr. Kelly, there's been some news reports of some comments that you've made about regulators. I don't want to ask you about those comments specifically, but I would like your view in terms of the role of regulators in leading up to the need for government assistance. I'd ask you several questions about events at Citi that prompted the need or requirement for government assistance. And I want to ask specifically this question with respect to the regulators. Were there any actions by any regulators that caused or contributed to Citi's need for financial assistance from the government?
No. No. And what I mean by that is that regulators are clearly players in the markets in the sense that they are participants and have various authorities with respect to the firms that they supervise. But there was nothing that the regulators did that, in my view, for what it's worth, led directly or indirectly to Citi's need for government assistance. Now, if you wanted to take a jaundiced view, which I don't, right, for all the reasons that I've described, you could argue that insofar as they were there and this happened, that they somehow must be complicit, but that's a far different issue.
We had tangentially talked about liquidity puts, not directly, but we talked about super seniors and question with respect to liquidity puts. What was the effect of these liquidity puts on Citigroup and its financial condition?
Don't know, but I do know. I don't know specifically. Again, wasn't involved. I can tell you that anecdotally I heard, obviously, that the impact was adverse because they were there, and I think in many cases they were exercised.
And taking that question just one step further, do you know if the fact of the liquidity puts and their exercise caused or contributed to Citigroup's need for government assistance?
For all the reasons that I've described earlier, just in terms of the perception of Citi, the market reaction, they were of a piece with that, but I don't know that they had any direct quantifiable impact, if you see what I'm saying. They were of a piece of a variety of factors.
Was Mr. Prince at all involved in the negotiations for government assistance?
Not to my knowledge. I think at that stage,
he was gone.
He'd been gone for a year. I think.
He was long gone.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It's November 2008, eight. Not 2007.
Yes. Yeah.
My apologies.
No,
you're correct. Because there are so many questions that I probably have forgot to ask you, Mr. Kelly, I'm going to defer to my colleagues, the remaining colleague, Ms. Norman and back to Ms. Poulin, to see if they have any additional questions that I may have overlooked in the course of talking to you.
Sure.
Ms. Norman?
I'm sure this is in the public realm.
I'm sorry?
I'm sure this is in the public realm.
Yeah.
And in the agreements, but if you could explain to me, what is the natural end of the government assistance agreement that Citi has right now?
Well, as you know, we've repaid the 20, and we
now you're out of the TARP house.
That's right, and we have unwound the ring fence agreement, which, as I mentioned, we paid rough number $7 billion for, and then I think we ultimately paid the government for the 1 year of coverage where we had had losses of about $9 billion. We paid them $5 billion for that, which was part of the unwind. So there was a very healthy fee that was earned by the government for the provision of that protection. What we have remaining is, as you know, $25 billion. It was the initial TARP injection that was converted to common stock or agreed to be converted into common stock in February or March, and then ultimately when the preferred exchange was done in July or August, was converted to common. It's 7.7 billion shares. Cost basis is $3.25. The government has announced that it plans to exit that position by the end of this year, in connection with the equity offering that we did in December. There was a 90-day lockup, which expires March 16th. The government's considering how it is it might dispose of those shares, and there are a variety of ways to do it. You know, they can do it through an underwritten offering. They can do it through a dribble-out program, continuous offering program in the market. They can do it through some combination of the two, but I know that the Treasury and the TARP office, Herb Allison and his people, are thinking through how it is that they want to affect those sales, but they've made it clear that they'd like to be out sometime over the course of the next year, if not by the end of the year.
And this probably won't be clear until the beginning of the following year, but what do you think net-net will be the cost to the U.S. government or the cost to Citi of that combined package, if you could net that out?
Well, I think what I can do... Well, we could get for you the amount that we've paid to the government in dividends, you know, with respect to the preferred interest. As I mentioned, we paid a combination of the Treasury and the FDIC, paid the FDIC 3, Treasury 4, but I think we ultimately solved that, PJ, by leaving 5 behind. I don't know how that was allocated. I think the FDIC may ended up with $3 billion and the Treasury with $2 billion in change, but I'm not positive.
Is this something that Citi has internally documented, what it expects the net?
I think the net, well, what I'm struggling with is trying to figure out how much money the government made. I don't think that, you know, based on what it is that we see so far, and look, I don't have perfect foresight. I have no idea where the stock price is going to end up. But as it stands, it made a lot.
Unlike Jane or even Brad, I have no accounting experience. But to me, it is very complicated, and it does seem to have been going up and down. But if we could...
It's not. See, you know, think about it this way, right? Because we've got, in other words, they earned dividends on the $20 billion, 8%. Is that standing for roughly a year? So they would have earned $1.6 billion on that. We paid them $5.2 billion, including the coupon that we paid on that 8% trust preferred during the period of 2009 while the insurance was in effect. So they got $5.2 billion plus the interest that they earned on that. They got repaid the 20, but they got a $1.6 billion coupon, rough numbers, and it's probably more than that because there are stub periods in there in terms of the interest they collected. And they have $25 billion of common stock, which probably today is worth $26 billion. To the extent the stock stays above 3.25, they have a gain, $7.7 billion times the difference between 3.25 and the market price. To the extent that it's below 3.25, they have a loss, same math, $7.7 billion times the amount that is below 3.25. So as it stands now, as I said, you know, they've got a $5 billion fee for a risk that never crystallized. It was insurance, which is important and valuable, but they get $5 billion for that. They got the interest associated with it, and they got $1.6 billion on the $20 billion, and they got some interest payment even before on the 25 before they converted to common stock.
With regard to the common stock, it depends on the stock price. With regard to everything else,
it's fixed.
We can give you the exact numbers. Mm-hmm. It's just arithmetic.
Yes. Yeah.
I think that would be helpful for me.
Sure.
It probably is in the public domain, but
it's no problem.
Thank you.
I mean, we'll just do the calculations. But they've made money so far.
I have a question on the off-balance sheet structures again. So for the CIVs and the CDOs and CLOs, Citi's recognized some losses on those arrangements, those off-balance sheet vehicles. Some of them come on balance sheet, and that's what caused the losses. But the Citi-administered ASPAC commercial paper conduits, I don't see the same thing going on with that group of off-balance sheet structures. Can you explain to me what it is about those structures that we're not seeing losses, and is there any liquidity issues in them now? Has there been?
No, I don't think so, but I'm going to defer to others, and we can find the right person to answer that question. I think my impressionistic view is in all the assets that you've cited, there have been marked losses. Mm-hmm. I suspect there just haven't been, in other words, there have been marked losses or credit losses. In what you've described, I think there may not just not have been any losses.
So it may be the composition of the assets.
Precisely.
So I'm curious, is it the composition of the assets? Is it the structure of the entities? Is it long versus short assets and liabilities mismatch?
My suspicion
in some structures, not in others.
It's probably, well, you're right, because composition of assets and length of funding are related, because the assets can be money good, but if they're short liquidity, you're obviously going to have a problem with selling them at a fire sale, but I just don't know, but somebody can figure that out.
My recollection was with the CIVs and the CDO structures, it was credit and liquidity.
Yeah, but in the CIVs, remember, I keep coming back to that, it really wasn't credit.
It was liquidity. Okay.
I'm not saying it was absolutely not credit, but as we discussed, I mean, were relative. The credit judgments were actually quite good. It was the fact that liquidity dried up and they had to be sold into distressed markets.
Okay. So that would be an open question, just so that we can understand those structures versus the others. It'll help us better understand
absolutely.
Our balance sheet.
We can track that, sure.
Mr. Kelly, I always like to ask someone at the end of an interview if there's anything that we didn't cover that you expected to talk about, or is there any question that we didn't ask you that you were expecting?
Not at all. I think you were very comprehensive. I'm trying to do my best, and I appreciate it.
Well, Mr. Kelly, I think, do we have any, Ms. Dubas, do you have any
questions?
Anyone else?
Thank you.
We certainly appreciate your time and that of Citigroup in cooperating with our inquiry. As I mentioned at the outset, it is our inquiry's confidential, so we ask that you not discuss what we talked about outside of your attorneys, of course. We certainly appreciate your time. Mr. Carp, did you have anything?
I do not. Thank you.
We did have I'm reminded by Jane that we had a few accounting questions to break down some losses that we can do, I think, offline with
sure.
your accounting staff. It's just mainly a subclassification of what's already been disclosed in your public filings,
sure.
breaking down some of those losses. So we'll deal with that offline.
And Jane, I'm sure they can get the answers. In fact, if I had the K in front of me, I could probably figure out some of the answers with you, but they can easily go through and give you the
sure.
precise answers that you need.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate your time.
No, I know, absolutely. I do know.